Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. Today we have two interviews. We're talking with writer-director Azazel Jacobs about his new movie, Mama's Man. And we're talking with British actor and comedian Steve Coogan.
Ah! Oh my God! Ow!
Is he acting?
No, he's not that good.
This is Robert Davis. Today we have two conversations for you. The first was recorded earlier this year at the Sundance Film Festival, where I saw what's turning out to be one of my favorite movies of the year, a little movie called Mama's Man by Azazel Jacobs.
Who's there?
Sorry, Pops, it's just me.
Mikey, what are you doing here?
A problem with the plane, and I just figured that I'd leave tomorrow instead.
I'm glad we're gonna see one more day.
Mikey, are you married yet?
Married? I have a kid.
Yeah, Mom, Mikey's not a virgin anymore.
They canceled my flight. I was on hold forever, so I'm probably gonna go to tonight or tomorrow. Laura, do you know what it's like to watch your parents get old?
Mikey.
I'm just gonna stay a little bit longer, okay? Just a little bit longer.
Thank you for flying with All American Sky, and how can I help you? Customer, can you hear me?
Mikey, this is your wife, Laura, remember? Where are you? Why won't you call me back, and why won't you answer my call?
Mikey, could you come down, please? We want to talk with you.
I'm doing work for my job, Dad.
Don't you need to return home to your family, to your work?
You're asking me to leave? You just have to ask, and no. I'll go.
Mikey? Okay.
It's about a guy named Mikey who lives in California with his wife and child, but the story takes place in New York, where he has gone on a business trip and he's staying with his parents who have an apartment there. When it's time to go back home, though, he makes up all these excuses for why he needs to stay a little bit longer. So he stays, sleeps in his old room, rummages through his old things, visits old friends, old girlfriends. And the longer he's there, the more it seems like something's wrong with this situation, you know? I mean, his parents notice it, his wife notices it. What's going on? And this was interesting to me because lately there have been so many movies, almost all of them comedies, about arrested development, you know, about guys who are basically stuck at 14 years old. Ben Kingsley in The Whackness, every movie made by Judd Apatow, Pineapple Express, Superbad, Knocked Up, they all have characters like this. Step Brothers with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. You know, they're all about these guys who sort of proudly defy adulthood. And Mama's Man is not a heavy movie. It's a serious movie, but it has funny parts. But most of all, it sees this situation as dysfunction, you know? This isn't a movie that celebrates shirking your responsibility as a husband and father. This isn't a movie that makes fun of parents. In fact, Azazel Jacobs cast his own parents in the role of Mikey's parents, Ken and Flo Jacobs. And that's Ken Jacobs, the legendary avant-garde filmmaker, whose work we see a little bit of in Mama's Man. It's a great movie. And the other thing I'll say about it is that it was shot in Ken and Flo's actual apartment in Lower Manhattan, which is really just the most amazing loft you can imagine, almost as if it were meant to be filmed in. Every nook and cranny is filled with some little gadget or item that's interesting to watch. And Jacobs uses the space in really interesting ways to make you really disoriented. At first, it's hard to tell where things are in relation to each other. But he gradually burrows deeper into the apartment until you finally have a pretty good idea of how things are laid out. It's really cool what he does. So at Sundance, I asked him where he got the idea for this movie.
Well, I began writing initially before 2005 Sundance. I just started doing the first draft, and it kind of stemmed from just being at my folks' house and waking up and finding coffee and breakfast waiting for me and thinking, why did I leave this place? And I went home and I started writing this, and it started shifting into something else. And then I came out here in support of my friend's film Wrist Cutters and saw Half Nelson. And there was something in Half Nelson that I really wanted in Mama's Man. Something, and also I just knew that the people involved in that weren't involved in it for any other reason than trying to make something important for them. So I knew one of the producers, Alex Arlovsky, slightly, and wound up talking to him after the screening. we continued talking. I sent him Good Times Kid, and then I sent him the first draft of Mama's Man, and then it's just started kind of going from that place.
It's interesting. I just talked to Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck yesterday about Sugar. Have you had a chance to see that?
I have, yeah, and I'm big fans of theirs. Yeah. Absolutely. So we also share, so Paul Mazet, who's the producer of Sugar, also is one of the producers on Mama's Man as well. So we sharing the same places.
Well, Mama's Man is it's a really beautiful film, and you mentioned that you were inspired just by being at your parents' house. Did you live there too? So that was your house at one point?
Yeah, I was raised until going to school. So I was there until at least 18 years old, and then off and on. And whenever I go back to New York, I'm usually up in that bedroom staying there. Yeah, the place was an incredible place to be raised in, and you know, it's almost been made to shoot in.
It's better than any set that I think you could construct.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was way before part of the Mama's Man's, you know, plan before casting my folks. You know, really preserving this home was the top thing that I wanted to do.
So you cast your parents. Did that take some convincing, or were they eager to do it?
No, definitely not eager. It did take some convincing. I think it's just saying, all right, are you sure you want some actors laying in your bed and being in your kitchen and just being in the house? And I think they're, we'll rather do this than have actors. But I think once they started seeing, you know, once they started seeing Matt Bourne, who played Mikey, work, and everybody at the crew and Toby, everybody that was there and the producers, they really became part of something, got interested and had a good time with it.
And you were able to include a little bit of their work too. Your dad's films show up a few times.
Yeah, I mean, that was also something that was written in to the script, and I love this work and I wanted to be part of it. It's my way of kind of attaching myself to what he's doing and trying to figure out how it can fit into my world. You know, those weren't in any way editing afterthoughts. They were part of the story from the beginning. I wanted those as blocks to kind of build with.
So with all of these personal details, it begs the question of how autobiographical the story is.
There are a few similarities where, you know, obviously besides shooting with my folks and in the loft, you know, I do live in California, and I do go back and I stay in this place. There, you know, there's a bunch of differences. I have a sister that was extremely influential for me growing up, and I think it's clear that Mikey's the only child in the situation, has a whole other thing. There was a point in my life growing up that I was embarrassed of the house and of my folks and everything like that, and I took, when I was writing Mikey, I took that as kind of a point to keep going. What if I stayed that way and just wanted, my push against them was to be as kind of regular and normal as possible. But I think the biggest difference is that Mikey could never make this movie with his parents. You know, that's just not something that he could do. I think the movie itself is a testament for, you know, what my relationship is with them.
Do you think he's looking for some sort of sibling relationship?
I think he could. I think he's also, for me, he's looking for, like, what wrong turn? What situation? Was it the first girlfriend that, you know, he was mean to? Was it, like, should he have stayed with the guitar? Should he have done this thing? I think, you know, or what about his old friend? Should he have stayed best friends with his old best friend? I think all these things is really, in the end, becomes not what wrong turn he took, but like what he can do at this point. And I feel like when he leaves, for me, he's heading back home, but he's on a different path home. I think just going back with toys, I picture a different life for him.
It's such a beautiful final shot. It's almost like a dad's eye view, I think, there of the kid and the toy.
And my dad came up with that shot.
He did.
Yeah. That was really something that, you know, I wanted, my idea was that of him giving the toy to Mikey. I wanted the idea that my dad gave a toy to Mikey so that Mikey's world, he'd go back and his world. But my dad didn't feel like that was enough. He felt like it was still too downer of a film if you didn't see that Mikey actually really was going to get home. And so the blocks continuing over would be something that he came up with, which I think, you know, I'm so thankful for.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a bridge from the character's past into his future. Yeah.
And just the fact that the motion is the same, like that all is by chance, but it's just great, you know? And then I don't know if you caught it, but the last thing the baby says is he turns and looks and says, "Dad," you know? And it's because while we were shooting that baby's dad walked in and it just noticed it, you know? And I just think, like, you know, that's exactly the type of accidents that I'm hoping for whenever I'm shooting.
Yeah, yeah. Your parents are such a tender presence in the movie. It's clear that you have, or I would assume, have a strong relationship with them and a lot of respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, them caring about this film is really important to me, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that they respect it and appreciate it.
Yeah. Were any of the other actors in Mama's Man non-professionals, or did you? How did you cast?
Yeah, well, the old best friend is my old best friend, and that's his mom, and that's his parents' place, and that's his father's paintings, and yeah, I think that's the biggest, like, not. And then the ex-girlfriend is an actress, and the wife is an actress, and then Richard Edson, who plays the next door neighbor,
right?
Who I was very excited to have anything to do with Strangers in Paradise. I'm excited about.
Cool. There's a reference to Monsieur Verdu in the film, which I was, so I'm a big Chaplin fan, and so I was really excited to see that. Do you like the film?
Yeah, I'm also a big Chaplin fan. That's another person I want to have anything to do with. With Good Times Kid as well, I've tried to involve him in some way. This happened completely while we're shooting the scene. We're looking for a DVD to put on. That was the first thing my dad grabbed and put on there, and then that's the real sound. Like, we just start shooting and see what sound it would wind up. I guess this is not, you know, crazy, but for me it was really, like, perfect how it matched up. So we pursued getting the rights to that piece, and, you know, it became part of the story. So it's like a semi chance. It wasn't in the script. It came shooting, but it fit.
It does have some sort of weird thematic resonance too, that the Verdu character is away from his family all the time, sort of doing these other things that don't seem that healthy.
Yeah, and then the score, the movie music coming in at that time, and then, you know, it just was great, you know. And it was really, you know, I had to write a letter to the Chaplin estate, and that was just exciting for me, just to have anything to do with them, you know,
and to get a response.
Yeah, and saying, okay, go, you know.
So what is the planning process like for a movie like this? You're shooting in such a confined space. Do you storyboard?
I didn't storyboard. I've definitely generally don't storyboard. I do have ideas. I do draw while I'm writing. I do have ways of certain shots that I want to see certain ways. With this one, I was able to give the first draft to Toby and every other draft afterwards. So by the time we're shooting, he knew exactly what I was looking for. We did go to the house and shot some went to New York together and shot some tests. And
Toby's the cinematographer.
And so we were on the same page. We kind of, by that point, we really didn't have to discuss that much. And I felt like, for me, generally storyboarding is only reserved for things that are complicated and expensive, and we had time with this one. We're shooting in order, and we could really look and see, like, how to make this work, you know, like, where should we be standing for this and discuss it, you know. I mean, the producers, the whole thing behind this, they weren't just like, oh, you know, here's some money, go make this thing. They were beyond supportive and just like always pushing to figure out how to do this thing correctly, you know. So giving me space is one of those things to figure this time out.
That's cool. So even the shot where you're sort of panning around the
that one was that wasn't storyboard, but that was definitely a plan thing. Yeah. That was like, you know, that was one of these things where there's certain shots that I want to make it clear that this is a movie that we're shooting with a machine. You know, we're doing a lot of things that are kind of semi-documentary, you know, but I'm using zooms, and I'm hoping to just keep it clear that this is a film taking place in a film house, and that these things are all kind of borrowing from certain things, you know. I mean, huge inspirations for me would be films like, you know, Forbidden Zone or Hell's a Pop, and movies that are show that they're making movies and at the same time completely vital.
Right. it really pays off that we get a sense of the space. I mean, at first it feels sort of disorienting, like, where are we? But after a while, we sort of know where things are in relation to each other.
That was a thing that Toby and I spoke about. If you see in the beginning of the film, we started on one side of the house, and by the end, we're ending on the other side. And we really did try to be aware of how we're progressing through the house as the story goes.
Mm-hmm. And even the sounds and the sound design, too, because, like, the scene where he hears the message from his wife and erases it, and then we realize that we were sort of, along with him, tricked into thinking there was no one there.
I've always wanted to shoot one of those scenes. Like, that's a movie scene that I've seen so many times. And I'm like, how do you do that? And so I got really excited when I felt like it worked.
Yeah, that was cool. So what's next?
I'm working on a story. There's two things going on. One is an adaptation of a friend Pat DeWitt's book, which I'm very excited about, which has nothing. It's about a kid in a small town. Nothing that I really know about, but when I read, I feel like I know everything about. So I feel like that's a testament of what it could be. And then I've been working, developing with the producers of Mama's Man. We've been getting together next project, which is kind of a gangster love story.
Mm. Cool. Yeah,
something I haven't done before. I got it. I want to. Yeah, maybe my folks won't like it too.
So two new directions.
Yeah.
Have you adapted a book or any other material?
Never.
Before?
And I've really, you know, I've only written my own stuff, so I'm excited. We're working on this together, me and the writer. So that's a whole other thing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really excited, man. I feel like, you know, the whole idea is just to keep working.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much for talking
with
me. Yeah,
okay, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Well, Steve Coogan is much better known in the UK than he is in the United States, but he's been in a lot of things in the United States too, and maybe you've seen him without realizing it. If you saw Tropic Thunder, the Ben Stiller movie this summer, then you saw him. He played the director of the movie within the movie, you know, the British director in over his head. He was also in a movie called Tristram Shandy, which is a British film, but it got a wide distribution here in the US. It was directed by Michael Winterbottom. It's a very funny and literate movie. But one of my favorite things that he's done in this country is he was in a segment of Jim Jarmusch's film Coffee and Cigarettes, playing himself, Steve Coogan, egotistical actor. In the UK, he is known for lots of things, but especially this character that he's played on TV for many years called Alan Partridge, who's the host of a fake talk show called Knowing Me, Knowing You. That is named for the ABBA song, that's true. It's also called The Alan Partridge Show. And it's a little bit like Fernwood Tonight or The Larry Sanders Show. You know, it's actually a live comedy show shot like a talk show, but of course it's all scripted and it's very funny in a very British way. Now, he's currently promoting a movie called Hamlet 2, which you can read my reaction to that film on our website. I think J. Robert had a very similar reaction. Let me just say that we like other things that Steve Coogan has done much more than Hamlet 2, although Hamlet 2 does have particularly inspired use of Elizabeth Shue, the actress, who appears in a small role. By way of introduction, we'll give you a clip from Tristram Shandy. This is Steve Coogan and co-star Rob Brydon trying to one-up each other with our Al Pacino impersonations.
I do good Al Pacino too, but I don't do it in front of people all the time.
Because you don't have the confidence, I understand
that.
I do
have the confidence.
But I feel like I can get up there and do it.
I can do Al Pacino. You do it, I can do like Al Pacino in The Godfather.
Oh, he wasn't great. No, I'm my friend.
When The Godfather speaks like that, you disrespect the family.
No, in The Godfather, he talks like this.
No, Godfather speaks like that, you disrespect the
family.
No,
in The Godfather.
You have no depth to the way you speak.
Yeah, because there was no depth in those days. In those days, he talks like this.
You sound like a cartoon. You sound like a cartoon now. The Godfather.
I'm not. That's not what I'm doing. No. With respect.
The Godfather.
With respect. Well, let me do Pacino. Let me do Pacino.
That's the way I do Pacino.
Just let me do Pacino.
That's the way I was. Real fucking loud, like that. It's real fucking loud, big sound like that all the fucking time.
That's Columbo.
Here's J. Robert Parks.
You've done live performance comedy, TV and film comedy. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how those are alike and different, both in how you prepare and how you perform?
TV comedy, you're at one remove from the audience. So you can be in some ways more experimental and more subtle because you know that the people who are watching a show are going to be like a handful of people in a living room somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you can be more intimate and try things in a slightly unorthodox way. And also be quite minimal as well. You can be very minimal in your performance and be very small in the things you do. When you do live comedy, you are going to be performing in front of a large crowd of people, if you're lucky. if you're unlucky, it might be the same as doing a TV show in someone's living room. But when you do in front of a crowd of people, you have to, there's certain mechanical things that you kind of have to obey. Mm. A crowd all needs to be reassured about when the right time to laugh is. So you have to be very clear about that. You almost need a kind of a laugh now moment.
And how do you do that in performance? And is it because of how you pause? Or
you structure it and you kind of, as long as the construct of what you're doing is funny, you kind of tell the audience, this is when you laugh. You can laugh now. Mm. Indirectly, you kind of, the rhythm of something, you give the audience that permission to laugh. And then often you use the laughter as a kind of, as if you weren't expecting it, if you're doing in character, and you use that as if you're having a dialogue with the audience. Mm. So when they laugh, you might use their laughter to take offense in character. Yeah. That they're finding what you're saying funny, as if you didn't intend that. And there's lots of ways of doing that, but mechanically the audience have to know, you know, can we laugh now? They don't want them to be self-conscious, and the audience want to all laugh at the same time, and it's kind of a group activity, so they kind of, they all want to know, yeah, we're all laughing at the same time. Mm. I'm not a jerk for laughing because everyone else is laughing, and so there's a kind of little psychology to it. Mm. The other thing is you can't really do small, minute comedy moments. Mm. You know, if you're performing in front of 2,000 people, if you raise an eyebrow, not everyone's going to see it, you know? So what you have to do is, there are physical things you do. If you want to look as if you've misheard something, you might make sure that your head's turned away from the person you're talking to if you're having dialogue with someone on stage, so that when they say something that's supposed to shock you, you turn your head, you know, 180 degrees, and look shut. So you physically have to manifest things in a bigger way, just literally. And that sometimes means you wave your arms about and you use your arms and gesticulate in a certain way to tell the audience what you think of something if you're not speaking. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're speaking. You can say whatever it is you want to say and people will hear you because you've got a microphone and whatever. But you have to make things just more physical and be more mechanical. Mm-hmm. And you can... there is a degree of experimentation, but sometimes when I do a character on TV that I do live, when I do the character live, I almost have to make the character slightly cruder and slightly more caricatured for the stage than I would on TV.
And is film more like TV then?
Film is more like TV, obviously. Although film, you can afford to be even more subtle in some ways, because in terms of writing, there's you need some sort of emotional investment from the audience, in the way that if you're doing like a half hour comedy on TV, you don't necessarily need. I think there's kind of, it's like I say, it's difficult and not very good to try and make rules about it, because there's always examples that break those rules, but my general observation is that an audience will laugh at funny stuff if it's well written for, like, you know, a half hour and maybe a little longer. And on TV they'll laugh at stuff even if there's no emotional or ethical content to it. As long as the gags are strong, they'll do that. But after half an hour, they kind of want something more to sustain themselves, and they need to invest or in some way care, if not care about the character. Mm-hmm. They're compelled to know what's going to happen to that character. So when you're doing a movie, that's the tough part. Otherwise it'd be just like stitching 3 half-hour shows together. Mm-hmm. And it's so much more than that. You need to craft this kind of little journey for the audience to go on, and mm-hmm. that's the That's the tough part, yeah. In a way. Not finding funny stuff. It's making the funny stuff work with some sort of and giving it some sort of momentum.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. In a New Yorker profile last fall, you had this really interesting line. You said, "The spirituality of imperfection is what interests me." What do you mean by that, and how does that affect your work?
I think that when I say imperfection is, I mean things like flawed characters, people who have various sort of dysfunctions. Not that anyone lives a perfectly, a perfectly holistic life, but people who are in some way damaged, or the things aren't going right for them, or things are sort of dysfunctional. And not only characters like that, but moments in life, things where we interact with people, things that are uncomfortable, embarrassing, painful. Those moments, I like looking at those moments, especially through comedy, because if you look at that kind of pain and embarrassment and dysfunction through comedy, it's not stressful to watch.
Mm.
Because the comedy makes you laugh, and therefore you sugar the pill.
Mm.
And why I'm attracted to it is I think that when you look at those moments, it tells us more about being human than looking at someone who's living a well-adjusted life. And it's not necessarily saying, oh, these people are really great because they're dysfunctional. It just tells us a little bit more about what it is to be a human being and shed some light on it, to throw some light on the human condition. I think that's what Shakespeare said, is to shed some light on the human condition. Mm. If you can make people laugh, and sometimes not make people laugh and do that, sometimes, but when you make people laugh, it's because you're doing that. Sometimes there's a laughter, you can get the kind of laugh from an audience because you've done a good gag and it's well constructed. There's another kind of laugh you can get from the audience, which is actually where they are laughing because they recognize something you've said, or some observation you've made about being human that they realize is truthful, but they perhaps haven't thought of in that particular way before.
Mm.
And so it's like that everyone's learned a tiny bit more about themselves in that moment. So that's what I meant about
that. Dana Marsh is certainly an imperfect character. Mm. Is that sort of what attracted you to him?
What attracted me to him actually was that, yes, of course, he is imperfect and he's got issues and he's foolish and naive and stupid at times. And if there's a common denominator to sort of the roles I've played on film and in TV back in England, it's that it is that there are those sort of character flaws. But what appealed to me about him, which is something that I wasn't used to doing, was playing someone who's vulnerable and emotionally open and not cynical in any way.
Mm.
To play sometimes I'll play a character that's just sort of unattractive, but compelling in some way. And the idea of making the audience really care and really want a character that I play to succeed, and want them to come with, is something I hadn't done. And so for that aspect of it was a challenge to me. I thought, can I do this? It appealed to me, and there was a question mark there. I wonder if I can do this. And beyond that, the kind of bigness of it, that this was a very truthful, I really believe the character, but he is slightly larger than life. And I mean, that's not to say that you don't meet people like that in real life, because there are people who are larger than life that we meet. And I've met people like him, certainly, being in being sort of in entertainment. There's a kind of self and analytical navel gazing kind of thing you find on the West Coast of America, and there's a theatrical element you find in a lot of British theatrical actor type people.
Mm.
But the bigness of it was what attracted me. The idea of trying to do a believable, truthful but big performance without it being a caricature. That was the sort of toughness of it for me, and I like to do things that are have some sort of difficulty for me. I like to feel a little bit of fear before I do something.
Was it different playing an American character?
Yes and no. Yes, because of the technical, extra technical worry about, rather than am I being truthful or whatever, is am I getting the accent right?
Mm-hmm.
Really, he's just like playing any other character. You just want it to be truthful and real. And there, I think there was I found it difficult to conceive that the character I saw on the page would be British, because there's an emotional openness that I don't associate with British people generally. Mm-hmm. Although there's some people like that in theatre, generally I feel that that's a kind of a
an American trait.
That very open emotional lack of irony, which is what the character has in a way, is something you do find in California, and I can imagine that that guy would have been there for a certain period of time and soaked up a lot of that. Yeah.
The film has a kind of an improvisational feel in places. How closely were you guys sticking to the script, and how much were you improvising as you went?
I would say 90% of it was what was on the page. More than people think, and I think that's often like a compliment to the writing and direction, because when dialogue flows quite freely, people often assume it must be improvised, because sometimes that's because it doesn't sound over scripted. But it was pretty much what was on the page, and it did it when I read it. It did jump off the page at me. I didn't feel like I was reading a script when I first read it. I felt like the characters really came off the page, and I sort of knew who they were. I didn't feel I was reading a script, and that's the testament to Pam and Andy, the writers, having a good ear. When characters come off the page like that, it means that they sort of live a kind of. That then your job is only how to sort of render them, how to make them real. Improvisation did occur on occasions. I'd say, why don't we try this? It wasn't really so much improvising. There might be the odd ad lib, but it was normally in terms of. I wouldn't actually improvise on camera, I don't think. Maybe a little, a tiny bit, but some in between takes. Why don't we try this? What about if I say this? So go off script and say, why don't I just try and say this, or we'll figure it out. Say you say this, then I'll say that, and then we'll do this, even though it's not what's on the page. Let's do that, and then we'll shoot it immediately after we've just discussed it. So that's not quite improvisation, but it's certainly sort of thinking on the spot, which happened like I'd say 10% of the time, and helped. And some of the very funny moments in the movie are the result of those kind of taking those little leaps. So,
can you remember an example?
Well, there's a bit where I stare at a cat and tell the cat. I ask the cat, "What the fuck is your problem?" I say to the cat when. As if the cat's staring me out, which wasn't on the page. A lot of the stuff during the writing process, when I'm angst-ridden, and you know, I walk away and I'm not wearing any pants, and you know, I'm wearing a mask, and I start crying when I'm writing because I'm so overcome with emotion. All that was stuff that we tried out in situ, and we tried a bunch of different things to see what would be funny and what would be believable, and all that was the result of I'm gonna try. Why don't I try this? Why don't I try typing and start becoming tearful because I'm so overwhelmed with the words I'm writing? Let's see if that works. So all that stuff was stuff that was tried out. And that's an example of it.
The movie ends with this high school production, which of course is very different than Disney's High School Musical. But how do you think film audiences are supposed to take this musical? Because it strikes me as kind of absurd, and yet the audience within the film loves it, and Elizabeth Shue loves it. And so I'm curious how you think that we're supposed to take it.
I think that it's one of those things where the 12-year-old drama critic says sometimes something can be so bad that it turns out good. I think something that kind of you can. The question I asked actually when we were doing the movie is, how are people supposed to take this musical at the end of the movie? And I think that the sheer chutzpah of the performance and of the play and the conviction and commitment can just charm, can sort of, if you like, vanquish any cynicism. and it does happen. It does happen. Sometimes you go along and you go, I went to see a musical in London recently. I'm not remotely interested. It was called Into the Hood. With lots of fairy tales, but lots of hip-hop dancing in it. And I went along to just look at the technical aspects of the show, because I'm doing a theatre show, and I went along with a friend, and I thought, I'm not remotely interested in hip-hop music, I'm not remotely interested in that kind of street dancing, really. It's just not my... And yet, and they're all like, you know, 18-year-old kids doing this stuff. And yet, could I deconstruct it and tell you what the subtext was of the show? No, I don't think there really was one. But did I enjoy it? Yeah, I did enjoy it, because... I was charmed by the commitment and the sort of sheer sort of life affirming quality of the people in that show that it sort of it stopped me. And I went there with a kind of cynical, state as being my sort of normal disposition. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I thought I really enjoyed that, and I like those people, and I respect the show. And I think that so that to me is a kind of real thing. I believe that the show that they do at the end of this is one of those. It has a similar quality, although I'm not saying that the show I saw in London was ill-conceived, but I think that they had that kind of. You can imagine there's that it's a sort of something which is it's like when you see some sort of rock band who are not especially good musicians and they can't play especially well and the lead singer doesn't have an especially good voice, but they do a song that just has such commitment and drive that becomes the thing that you like about it, and you can't say one specific thing. It becomes more than the sum of its parts, and I believe that even though it looks like the worst idea ever, that there's that there's something that's authentically believable about it being successful.
You move between sort of smaller films and then big budget things like Night at the Museum and Around the World in 80 Days. What do you enjoy about the big productions?
Well, the thing about doing a big production is that it's However the movie turns out, it's an incredible experience. Especially if you're doing something where you sort of spend 3 months living in Berlin and 2 months living in Thailand, it's a great experience, and it's amazing to be part of something which is so. It's exciting. It's exciting, and it's. It's like this huge kind of, it's like an event, it's like an event in your life. And also there's a group of people you meet for the first time and you see them on a regular basis. And it's like an adventure. Yeah. So it's a very different experience from doing a low budget movie.
Sure.
And creatively there's less freedom. Mm-hmm. But as an experience, as a life experience, you remember it because it takes up a whole chunk of time. Yeah. And takes you outside of your life for a period. Mm. So it's like an adventure.
Yeah. Mm. Last question: is it too pretentious to say that your career has kind of a postmodern feel? Because you've had movies where you've played yourself. You've had characters where they seem like they were variations on other characters or riffing on other characters. And other times you seem to be playing roles in which you almost are responding to public perception of you. And it seems to me that you sometimes almost invite the audience to wonder what's really you.
Yeah, I do that deliberately. I've done that deliberately because it's interesting to me. Just because it's interesting and I haven't seen people do it before, you want to kind of try and push the envelope and use everything about. I like to use everything about myself to. I like to be experimental and sort of and do things that are kind of potentially
dangerous. I think he was going to say dangerous. You know what else is dangerous? Going to an interview with weak batteries in your digital recorder. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. If you have feedback for this podcast, for example, if you'd like to tell J. Robert Parks to load his digital recorder with new batteries before he goes to an interview, you can find us on the web at dailyplastic.com. There you'll find more episodes in this series of podcasts, and you'll also find what else we're up to. You can leave us a comment, or if you prefer to leave us an audio comment, call 415-287-4020 and record your voice. We'd actually love to hear from you either way. Tell us what you think of this episode or other episodes. Tell us what you think of these filmmakers. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more new stuff. Bye.
I'm Alan Partridge. I host a chat show called Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge. Don't believe the critics. The show is good. Watch it.